Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. Welcome to episode 164 of the Garden DC podcast. In this episode, we chat with John Bogan, a retired Smithsonian botanist, all about begonias. The plant profile is on Salvia Black and Blue, and we share what's going on in the garden as well as some upcoming local gardening events in the What's New segment. We close out with The Last Word on Raspberries by Christy Page at the Food Gardening Network. This episode, we're joined by John Bogan. He is a retired Smithsonian botanist and a begonia enthusiast. Welcome, John.
Hi, Kathy.
Great to have you on, and we're going to be talking about all things begonias. And first, though, we want to talk a little bit about you, John, and your background. And we've known each other for years through GardenCom, the Garden Communicators Association, through group you started, I think, called DC Tropics.
That was a long time ago, yeah.
Yes. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about that group too. But we like to ask our guests on the Garden DC podcast, were they born with chlorophyll in their veins and a green thumb?
I don't know about born, but I started at a pretty early age. So my father always had a vegetable garden, like going back to when I was like 4 or 5 years old. And he told me that I always wanted to be out in the garden working with him. And my mother always grew houseplants indoors, so I kind of got it, I guess, from both sides.
Hmm. And when you were helping in that vegetable garden as a child, did you enjoy it or did you consider it a chore?
I actually don't remember, at least that early. Now, I will say that we had a bigger vegetable garden when I was a teenager, and that I hated. I mean, I hated it. I hated the weeding, I hated the digging, I hated the harvesting. The only thing I liked about it was actually eating the vegetables that we grew. So I guess that sweetened the deal a little bit.
Definitely. And can you describe, were you growing up, I think, in Buffalo, New York?
Yeah, so I grew up in a suburb, one of the southern suburbs of Buffalo, New York. The area is known as the South Towns. And I grew up in a fairly rural area. My family had moved from Syracuse to the Buffalo area when my father took a new job, and we lived pretty much in the middle of nowhere. It's a lot more developed now, but 50 years ago, it had been farmland previously, and there was still a lot of farmland around there, but there were also some old growth woods that I just found fascinating. And this was back in the days when you could wander around as like a 7 or 8 year old with no adult supervision, apparently. And I would just wander through the woods and see the wildflowers, and they were just so interesting. And I'm really not sure why I was so interested in them, but I was just fascinated by them, like the trilliums and the jack and the pulpits, and I needed to know the names of all of them. So I guess I really was a budding botanist back then.
Mm-hmm. Well, who wouldn't be fascinated by trilliums and jack and the pulpits? They're such wonderful wildflowers.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're lucky as a child to be able to have experienced them and to be, you know, kind of, what do they call it now, a wild child or untethered. There's different words for it now. So from your childhood and your plant experiences, how did you transition to a career as a botanist?
Well, it took a few turns along the way because I got involved in 4-H as a kid. And my 4-H club specialized in insects. So I actually ended up going into entomology in college. I started out in kind of general biology, ecology, evolution, that kind of thing, but it ended up in entomology. And I actually worked in an insect collection at Cornell University for several years after finishing my undergraduate. And it was only several years after that that I decided to go back to school and get a master's degree in botany.
And then with that degree, where did you go on to?
When I finished my master's, I got a job offer at the Smithsonian, and that was 1991. And I stayed there for a little over 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's great to hear about job security these days.
Yeah, it is. I mean, especially now that I'm retired, I got to say that the pay, especially at the beginning, the pay wasn't great, but the benefits were good. And yeah, I really can't complain now that I'm retired. And there were parts of my job that I didn't love. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really liked my department. I liked the people that I worked with. I liked my bosses. I had a bunch of different roles within the department. I did some research work. I did a lot of collections management. I ended up doing a lot of data management. And the problem there was that I didn't really enjoy data management, but it was what I was good at.
I can relate to that. So it was mostly computer and paperwork and not so much with the plants.
Towards the end of my career, yeah. I mean, I worked with specimens. I mean, I worked with a lot of dead plants. But that's why I think I enjoy gardening so much, because it gives me a chance to work with living plants.
And what does the Smithsonian do with the botanical information? Like, why does the federal government or the Smithsonian employ botanists?
They're involved in a lot of different research projects. I mean, it's very much a research institution. The public doesn't really know much about the research wings of the Smithsonian, especially botany, because botany, there's no botany wing in the public parts of the museum. But the Smithsonian employs several people who collect plant specimens, who identify plant specimens, who study plants and publish about them, and also provides those resources to visitors from all over the world. I mean, a lot of research visitors come and use the collections of the Smithsonian, because the herbarium is one of the, I believe, top 10 in the world.
And for those who come to DC and visit, you can get permission to get access, as John said, to some of those collections. I was a docent for several years at Natural History, and I got to see some of those behind the scenes. And it's fascinating what you don't see in the museum that's in those file cabinets and shelving and collections. There's so much more that's behind those displays. So, John, you are one of those lucky people that has two gardens to garden in. So let's talk first about your DC garden.
Okay. I'm not sure I would consider that lucky at this point, because it's kind of twice the burden.
Well, can you describe where you garden in DC, the climate, the soil, what you're growing?
Yeah. So, so we've had our house in Washington since December 2000, and it's a row house. So it's a very small, modest house with, I guess you would consider it a big backyard by city standards. But the entire lot is only 20 feet across. So we are talking very small garden. And for a long time, I gardened it very intensively. I tried a lot of different things. It was very challenging because it's on a hillside. So I had to deal with weird shade, because it was a north-facing hillside. So it got no sun for a lot of the year, and then blazing sun just for a couple of months in the middle of the summer. The soil, I'll tell you, was terrible. The area generally has very heavy red clay as its native soil. But in my case, the soil was amended with things like construction rubble and broken bricks and rusty nails and broken glass. So that was a challenge. I learned early on to always garden with gloves on. I can't tell you the number of times I cut myself. So it was a very small garden. I mean, when my husband and I bought this house in Rehoboth Beach, which is where I am right now, I really started neglecting the garden in Washington, because this is where I'm putting all of my time and energy now. I have a half-acre lot here, which is huge compared to what I had previously, and I'm replacing the lawn bit by bit with gardens.
And your passion, I think, is tropicals?
I've got a lot of passions. lately, I've been getting a lot more into native plants. I've been adding a lot more native plants to my gardens, but what I want to do is I want to integrate native plants into a more, I wouldn't say a formal garden, but more of a fairly typical garden. I mean, I grow a lot of different things. A lot of the things that I grow are not native. A lot of the things that I grow are subtropical, not truly tropical so much, because I don't want to replant things every year. I don't want to be dragging things in and out, because I'm getting too old for that. I want things that come back. So I do grow a lot of perennials. But like I said, I'm trying to mix natives with non-native plants. And ultimately, I want to have as little lawn as possible and as much garden as possible.
And so we mentioned earlier that DC Tropics group, is that still active? Is it online? Is it a Facebook group?
We don't meet anymore as a group, which is kind of unfortunate, because I met a lot of really, really good people through that group. It sort of transitioned to a Facebook group eventually. And the name of the Facebook group is now Mid-Atlantic Tropics, because it's not really based in DC. It's based in like the entire Mid-Atlantic region at this point. So if anybody's looking for it on Facebook, you would find it under Mid-Atlantic Tropics.
Great. And so let's transition to kind of the tropical-y plant we're talking about today. Can we call begonias tropical? I'm not sure. They certainly have that big, gorgeous leaf, and maybe some of them originate in tropical regions. So let's talk about first the begonias that we would first encounter as a home gardener or a houseplant person going to the garden center. And I think those some of those common varieties.
Well, first of all, the begonia family is a huge, huge family. And the interesting thing is that there's only two genera in the entire family. One genus is the genus Hillebrandia, and there's only one species, and it occurs in Hawaii, which is really weird. But all the rest of the species are in the genus Begonia. So the genus Begonia has about 1,500 species. It is one of the biggest plant genera in the world. And it is primarily tropical. There's a lot of subtropical species. And I would say that a lot of the begonias that people know as houseplants are probably from the tropical and subtropical regions. If you're growing them as houseplants, you might be growing like the, people call them, like to call them angel wing begonias. Those are some of the bigger begonias. They have kind of a big, almost bamboo-like stalk. The Begonia Society likes to call them cane-like begonias, because the stem is, it's almost like a cane. And that's a really popular group of houseplants. There's a lot of rhizomatous begonias. Those are begonias that generally don't produce an erect stem. They have a rhizome that creeps along the soil. And those, a lot of those come from, I would say, subtropical regions, not really tropical. There's things like the Rex begonias, which are a primarily Asian group. And that's just a group of a huge, huge group of hybrids that, you know, and that's one of the begonias where some people can do great and some people just can't grow them. Now, if you're talking about outdoor begonias, there's the common bedding begonias. They're the people call them wax begonias sometimes, or the sempervirens begonias. And that's a hybrid group that comes from a group of species in Brazil, primarily in South America. So where were we going again with that?
Well, I think that was a great overview of some of the what the begonias you would encounter and the major groups. And I think a lot of people are also familiar with that hardy garden begonia that can grow in the Mid-Atlantic that is not native here, but it does reseed a bit. It's kind of, it's usually got that pinky type flower, and maybe about the, if it's really happy, it will grow to about knee height. It usually likes to fill in dark, like moist crevices in a rock wall or along steps is where I usually see it in a shade garden.
Yeah. So the begonia that you're talking about is Begonia grandis, and it's commonly known as the hardy begonia. And that's actually a pretty good name for it, because it's the hardiest begonia in a group that, like I said, is almost entirely tropical and subtropical. And one of my interests has always been things that are hardy that look like they shouldn't be. I'm interested in things that look tropical, but that, like I said, I don't want to be dragging them in and out every year, and I don't want to have to keep replanting them every spring. So I like things that come back, but I also like things that look tropical, and the begonias kind of fit that bill. So Begonia grandis, it's from China. But it's very, very widely cultivated all around the world. You actually can't grow it in the tropics because it needs that cold period in the winter when it does go dormant.
Yeah, and I think that's important for people to know that it does go dormant, that, you know, it's not an annual, that it's going to come back. And it pretty much is a prolific spreader by seed, I find. It does have a little bit of stoloniferous growth, I think, but it's really the reseeding that brings it back.
Well, it grows from tubers. It has it produces a small tuber, and that's what overwinters. Now, what you're seeing as seedlings are actually, it propagates vegetatively. It produces little bulbils. They're little propagules in the leaf axils. And those drop off and fall to the ground. And it's actually a method of asexual reproduction. So what you're getting is a colony that's all a clone of that original plant. The funny thing is I've had it go to seed in my garden, and it grows from seed easily. I can grow it indoors. If I sow the seeds in a pot, I get great germination. I have never once found it actually growing from seed in my garden. They've all come up from these little bulbils that fall off of the plants. And that's actually kind of a little mystery to me, because it's like, well, it produces good seeds and they're easy to grow from seed. Why doesn't it reproduce from seeds in my garden? And that's just one of those little mysteries.
Well, I think it sounds like begonias are a great plant because they are prolific spreaders or reseeders or bulbil spreaders. I don't even know if there's a technical term for a bulbil spreader. But maybe we'll just jump right into propagation and then talk a little bit about begonia care after that. So aside from them spreading themselves around, how can we, as a begonia collector or somebody who might go to somebody else's house and see a beautiful begonia that we want to share, propagate that plant?
Well, if you're talking about some of the more common house plants, a lot of them you can grow very easily from leaf cuttings. Mm-hmm. Now, if they produce a stem, you can often do them from a stem cutting. And with the angel leaf types or the cane-like begonias, those, for whatever reason, you cannot propagate those from leaf cuttings. The leaf will root and they never produce plants. So those you do have to propagate from stem cuttings. But most other begonias you can produce from a leaf cutting. And you can just take a leaf and stick it in. I don't recommend putting it in water. A lot of people do. I just find it easier to just put it directly in soil. So put it in a bit of potting soil with a plastic bag over it and just keep it someplace bright but not in direct sun. And they'll put out roots and new little plants in no time. You can even cut the leaf into pieces, and you can usually get a new plant from every piece of the leaf. They're incredibly easy to propagate. I think that's one reason why begonias are so popular.
Mm-hmm. And when you say place the leaf, are you talking about horizontally laying it on the soil or actually kind of vertically inserting it into the soil?
It doesn't really matter. That's the funny thing. They're so easy to propagate. Now you can take the whole leaf and just stick the petiole in the soil and it'll root and produce new plants. Or you can lay the entire leaf flat on the soil. This is a very old-fashioned way to do it. You lay it flat on the soil and then you nick the veins and it'll produce a new plant at each nick. But I find it easier to just cut the leaf into sections and you just make these little leaf wedges. And as long as each section has one of the veins in it, you just stick it vein down in the soil and it'll root and produce new plants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so easy. And I think it's one of the best things as a pass along plant because you can literally mail that leaf to somebody, right?
So, oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It can be off the plant for several days. It doesn't have to be like fresh cutting stuck right in. So like many succulents and other plants, you can actually share it by mail.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. As long as it doesn't dry out. So you want to pop it into a plastic bag. You don't want it to get too hot and you don't, because that'll cook it. You don't want it to freeze and you want to keep it out of direct sun because that'll cook it. But yeah, they will last for days in a plastic bag, and sometimes they'll even start producing roots while they're in the plastic bag with no soil, no water, anything.
That is my kind of plant, John. Live without soil and care or anything. But yeah, you want to get it planted probably soonish once it arrives. Yeah. And so let's talk about the soil it likes. So what do most begonias like to grow in?
There are a few odd begonias that I'm not going to go into that want really specialized conditions, but most of the begonias that most people are going to come across want pretty much the same kind of soil. They want something that's very well drained, very loose and porous, that doesn't stay wet. That's the important thing. There are very, very few begonias that want wet soil. They want to stay moist, but with a very well aerated soil. And most of them, you want to let them even dry out a little bit in between waterings. So I generally use very standard potting soil mixes. I use Miracle-Gro, I use Pro-Mix, I use all different brands. I wouldn't say that there's one brand that's better than another. It's all about the soil texture. As long as the soil is well drained and doesn't pack down and you don't keep it wet all the time, I do often add a little bit of extra perlite because that does help lighten up the soil a bit. But otherwise, a lot of it is really about how you water it, and you just don't want to overwater them.
That's going to be a problem for me, John, because I am a member of Overwaters Anonymous.
Yeah. Well, all the more reason for a really well-drained soil then.
Mm-hmm. So, and maybe a clay pot rather than a plastic pot for good drainage, or what do you recommend?
If you tend to overwater, then maybe a clay pot. But for me, I use plastic pots pretty much exclusively. Because for me, I don't want to be watering every day. I do want them to retain a little bit of moisture. And I just find clay pots more versatile in a lot of ways.
For the plastic ones, you mean?
Yeah. Did I misspeak? Yeah, plastic
pots. Yes. So you mentioned watering. And so do you prefer to take it to the sink to water to let it drain out, that method? Or do you water them in where they're growing?
I generally water them right where they're growing. I mean, I know my plants pretty well, so I generally know how fast they dry out. I know how much water I need to give them. You don't want them to sit in a saucer of water for more than an hour or two. But generally, I just water something until the water comes out the bottom and then wait a bit. And if it is ever standing in water for more than an hour or two, I will dump it out. But that's pretty unusual. I should say that I really don't grow a lot of begonias in pots. Mm-hmm. At least not anymore. I grow most of my begonias outdoors in the ground these days.
So let's talk about them for a minute and the watering routine for that. Obviously, they can get rained on. And when it's not raining, how often do you water them?
Very rarely. Most begonias are more drought tolerant than people realize, especially if they're growing in the shade. Now, if they're growing in, there are some that grow in full sun. Like if you're growing the Sempervirens types, those are the very common bedding begonias that people grow as annuals. Those can take quite a bit of sun. They might wilt a little bit, so those you might want to keep watered during a dry period. But I very rarely water them unless we've had an extended drought.
And is an indication drooping or a little bit of brown edges? When do you know to water them?
I would say either one of those. If they're drooping, especially if they're drooping at night, if they're still wilted at night, and they don't look better by morning, that's generally a pretty good indication that they do need water.
Because some of the drooping could be because of high heat, but they'll put up with that, correct?
Yeah, I mean, they'll often wilt a little bit during the day just because it's very warm. And if it's a little bit on the dry side. But like I said, if they perk up at night, that's a good sign.
Great. And for indoor begonias, what's the best light situation you can give them?
The ones that you're growing indoors generally want the same kinds of conditions. They want bright, indirect light. There are some that can take full sun, but I would say most of the ones that you grow as houseplants, I would say morning sun would be good for a lot of them, as long as they're not getting direct sun like during the hottest part of the day. I would say bright, indirect light for pretty much all of them.
Mm-hmm. So maybe eastern exposure.
If you have like big north windows that get a lot of light, that's perfect for a whole lot of houseplants, but especially begonias.
Great. And then you had mentioned for the outdoor ones, put them in a shady situation, definitely not afternoon sun.
It depends on what you're growing. Like I said, the bedding begonias, the Sempervirens types or the wax begonias, a lot of those, I'm amazed to see those growing in full sun. I don't... Mm-hmm. For me, the ones I grow don't want that much sun, so I'm always a little surprised. They do seem to take full sun. If you grow the dragon wing types, those are a fairly new hybrid type, but those get much bigger leaves and they grow much bigger plants. Those can take a fair amount of sun as long as they're getting enough water. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a general rule of thumb that the more sun a plant gets, the more water it needs, or the more water you can give it, the more sun you can give it.
And so fertilizing is next on my care question list. So I would imagine that those grown in pots or indoors would need a bit of fertilizing.
Not a lot. I do fertilize the ones that I grow indoors occasionally, not really often. You generally want something that's a balanced fertilizer, like 10-10-10, and that would be I always get these mixed up. There's the middle one is phosphorus, the first one is nitrogen, and the last one is potassium. It's
NPK.
Yeah. So generally, the really leafy types do like a lot of nitrogen, but we're not talking huge amounts. I mean, I would say fertilize very lightly. And then the outdoor ones, I very rarely fertilize at all. My attitude is that if the soil is good, they don't really need fertilizing. When I plant them, I'll add some compost to the soil, and then I may add something like, lately I've been using an organic fertilizer called Espoma Plant Tone, which I think improves the soil more than anything else. It provides some nutrients, but a lot of it is really just about the soil health.
And so I'm going to ask you a dreaded question, I think maybe amongst begonia people, is the shedding and cleanup, especially for the houseplant one. So they tend to self-shed the blooms, and you're not having to do any pruning or snipping or deadheading too much, right?
Yeah, I mean, the ones I grow don't generally bloom indoors, and when they do, it's not a problem. Some of them produce hundreds of flowers, and they can get a little bit messy as they start to shed the flowers. But wouldn't you rather have the flowers? I mean, I think it's a small price to pay to have something blooming indoors.
Mm-hmm. I think it's similar to, you know, like a Boston fern. That's the price to pay. You're going to have cleanup every day, a little bit on the floor around it just to check on it. And maybe if you have pets.
It's the nature of plants that they're a little bit messy. I mean, they're part of the natural world, and the natural world is messy. When you invite the natural world into your home with you, you're inviting a little bit of that mess in with you. And it just sort of comes with the territory. I never really thought about it that way. Maybe because I'm not the best housekeeper to begin with. But plants shedding leaves or shedding flowers, I've never really considered that a nuisance.
Mm-hmm. And how about any other pruning or grooming that they need?
Well, the ones that produce stems can sometimes get a bit gangly, like the cane begonias. Some of them can grow like 6-8 feet tall if you let them. I mean, I've seen photos of people with them like brushing their ceiling. Wow. And I'm like, you know, cut that thing down. Now, the way that those grow is that they produce a clump of stems that all come up from the base. They don't branch very much. They'll branch a little bit if you cut them back, but they just keep sending up new growth from the base. And so you can just cut off those old canes right at the base, and it'll set up new ones. And that's really the best way, I think, to prune those. Most other begonias, like the rhizomatous ones, all you really need to do is take off the dead leaves. They don't really need a whole lot of pruning.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking is, you know, if you see any brown tips or any actual dead leaf, just kind of edit those out. And then the rest is, you know, pretty low maintenance.
Yeah. And one of the dirty little secrets is that you can take all those leaves off. I mean, begonias, as long as they have a healthy rhizome or stem, you can take all of the leaves off. Like if you have a pest problem, sometimes that's something that you might want to do. Or if it's just looking kind of ugly and you want to refresh it, you can cut those things down, and they'll generally survive and put out new growth.
Wow. And that does bring up my next question, which is insects and disease that are common to begonias and how to deal with those.
Yeah, they do have pests indoors. I mean, indoor plants in general do, and that's one reason why I grow fewer plants indoors lately. You're more likely to get pests if you're bringing a plant in from outdoors. So you might have things like thrips or a big problem for me was mites. There are mites that are more or less microscopic, like broad mites. You don't see them until they're doing damage to the leaves. And even then you need like a microscope to see the actual insects. In a case like that, I would just cut all of the leaves right off the plant. And that would often get rid of the infestation right there. You might have trouble with white flies. You might have trouble with aphids, sometimes thrips. Mildew, powdery mildew, is probably one of the big ones. But outdoors, that's one reason why I like growing plants outdoors. Pests are very rarely a problem for me outdoors, especially on begonias. So I got to say, grow the plants outdoors.
And if you do have them as a houseplant, you can, of course, bring them outdoors for the, you know, summer months, maybe like May 15th, October 15th in the Mid-Atlantic is probably a good window for them.
Yeah. I mean, you want to bring them out after they're not going to get frosted. I'll tell you, a lot of them, if they do get frost damage, don't give up on them because they'll often recover. But yeah, you want to move them outdoors. The general rule of thumb in the Mid-Atlantic area is around Mother's Day. Mid-May, that's when you can usually get plants outdoors and not worry about frost anymore. The fall is a lot iffier. You kind of have to pay attention to the forecast. But in the city, at least, I've had my first killing frost come in like mid-November or even early December sometimes. And now that I'm in southern Delaware, I may not see frost until sometime in December regularly. So I can leave plants out here pretty late.
Great. So let's turn to some of your favorite begonias. And I was going to ask if you're a flower or a foliage person, or do you like them both equally?
I see flowers as a bonus, but for me, I like growing for foliage. I don't like flowering plants that you grow only for the flowers, because that means that they're often ugly when they don't have flowers. And what's great about, I would say, most begonias, that a lot of them are beautiful foliage plants, even if they never bloomed. Now, a lot of the ones that I grow right now, they're related to the Rex begonias. They're a group of Asian species that have beautiful, beautiful foliage. And those are the ones that I'm growing primarily outdoors these days.
And are those the ones that kind of have that curlicue, like snail patterns to them, and sometimes striping and spotting?
Yeah, so a lot of them are in the Rex group. Now, Rex begonias have kind of a reputation for being difficult. And the one that you're talking about is probably escargot, which is one of the most spectacular Rex types and is also one of the most notoriously difficult to grow. It's I've never grown it, but what I've heard is that it's very susceptible to powdery mildew. A well-grown plant is spectacular, but apparently it's been the downfall of a lot of people who try to grow begonias. But the old-fashioned Rex types, I think, were a little more temperamental. A lot of them were based on species that are from the Himalayan region that really don't like heat. They don't like high humidity. Some of the newer hybrids that are coming out involve other species that are from like southern China. And a lot of those can actually take a lot more summer heat. And those are the groups that I'm trying to work with, because I'm trying to produce I'm an amateur plant breeder, and I'm trying to produce begonias that are hardy but can also take the summer heat.
And let's talk about some of that breeding you're doing. Are you selecting for certain qualities that you're looking for besides the heat and humidity tolerance? Are you selecting for looks?
Well, I'm selecting, I would say, equally for foliage. I want plants that look nice as foliage plants, but that can also take both the heat of the summer and are hardy in the ground. Like I said, I don't want to be hauling plants in and out all the time. I want things that stay in the ground and come back the next year. So I've been working with a group of species that are, like I said, primarily from southern China, and I've been testing a lot of hybrids, like other people's hybrids, in the ground to see how hardy they are. And some of them have proved to be a lot hardier than I think anybody ever realized, as long as you plant them deeply. And that's where I think a lot of people go wrong. A lot of people think if it's a rhizomatous begonia, you need to plant that rhizome right on the surface. And that's kind of the standard advice for rhizomatous begonias in general. With these hardy ones, you actually want to plant that rhizome a couple of inches deep, and it will not kill the plant, and it will help it get through the winter, because you want to get it below the frost. You want to get it below the frost zone.
That's great advice. I have the Sterling. Is it called Sterling Moon?
Yeah.
New introduction. And that one is still in the large pot it came in. So I plan to plant it this fall. And so I'll plant that deep and maybe even give it an extra mulching around that stem.
Yeah, I mean, extra mulch does help. Now, I would recommend planting these in the spring rather than the fall, mm-hmm. because you want to get these things established in the ground. You want them to have a good root system. You want to have them to have a nice, healthy rhizome. So my recommendation is to plant these sort of marginally hardy or hardy begonias in the ground in the spring. And what I do is I actually plant them in a little depression. I plant them in a little somebody asked me once, why do I plant all my plants in little divots? And there's a couple of reasons. One is that it makes it easier to water them because the water kind of runs in and goes where I want it to go. But also in the fall, I can throw some mulch or some soil over it, and that helps get the rhizome through the winter. And like I said, they really don't mind being a couple of inches deep. They'll just send up new shoots in the spring as long as the ground didn't freeze too deeply.
And can you describe some of the breeding work that's being done by some of your colleagues and some of the new introductions that you might be trialing or keeping an eye on?
Well, the one that you just mentioned, Sterling Moon, that's part of a new series by plant breeder and plant explorer and plant introducer, Ozzie Johnson. And he's working with the ladies at Plants Nouveau. And they're actually working with some of my hybrids also. They have one that they're just now releasing called Summer Storm, and that's one of my own hybrids, and I think it's a really, really cool plant, and I'm very pleased with it. But they're working with, they have a bunch of new ones in the works from Ozzie Johnson. Terra Nova Nurseries has released a whole bunch of begonias, and they are saying that they're hardy, some of them at least to zone 7. I have not trialed any of their begonias, and I really can't comment on them except to say that in photos, at least, they are beautiful. And some of those are starting to hit the market. I can't give you the names of any of those off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. Another breeder that's coming out is Ball Horticulture. And they've come out with several. I think that they're responsible for the Jurassic series. Now, the Jurassic series of begonias, again, these are sort of the Rex-like begonias, kind of the new wave of the Rexes, where they're a lot more heat tolerant. They tend to produce more of an erect stem. And just have really spectacular foliage. Now, they're not marketing those, I don't think, as hardy begonias, but I wouldn't be surprised if at least some of them are pretty hardy if, like I said, if you plant them deeply and give them an inch or two of mulch in the fall, I'll bet a lot of those would survive the winter. So I now that I have a little more space to grow plants, I'm hoping to try some of those other begonias.
Interesting. So Terra Nova, for our listeners, is based in the Pacific Northwest. So their zone 6, 7, 8 might be a bit different from our mid-Atlantic DC area 6, 7, 8.
And their summers are very different because their summers generally tend not to be quite as hot and humid. And that's something that we have to contend with in the mid-Atlantic region.
Yeah, for sure. I think they have slightly milder winters, but they almost have a droughty summer, but of course more dry, not as hot and humid, depending on the elevation as well. So let's talk about some begonia relatives and begonia maybe companions. So maybe start with, what are great plants to grow with begonias?
Pretty much anything that likes bright shade. I think that ferns go really, really well with begonias. And I especially like some of the maidenhair ferns, some of the adiantum species, because they have this beautiful, very fine, lacy foliage. And I think it's a really, really nice contrast to almost any begonia, because the begonias tend to be very big, very bold leaves, and often have a lot of flashy colors, or at least a lot like silver splashing. And I think that the ferns in general just provide a really, really nice contrast to that, with much finer, more uniformly green foliage. Hostas need pretty much the same conditions as a lot of the outdoor begonias. So I think that hostas are generally good companions, although I think they might compete a bit in the foliage arena.
Yeah, I think that's true, especially, you know, if you got the same tones of hostas, say like a blue green with a bluish or steel colored begonia. They could kind of play off each other, or you could go the opposite, you know, and do a guacamole toned hosta and compete that or contrast that with the begonia leaves. Mm-hmm. And so some begonias I've been seeing are being bred for really dark foliage, like almost black. What do you think about that?
I have kind of mixed feelings about it. They can look a little bit depressing to me, but on the other hand, they're such a bold contrast to other plants. I think that if they were played up, especially against something like a nice bright green fern, I think something like that, just the contrast would work really, really well. But you know, one of these days I'm gonna plant a garden that's just all dark plants and see how it works, but then just have a few little things here and there, like something, a little pop of bright color or a pop of something bright green. And, you know, it would either be a work of genius or everybody would hate it. It would be one or the other. I'm not sure which.
Yeah, I agree. I think sometimes the dark foliage could be a great foil and, you know, contrast for texture and stuff. But a lot of times, especially in the outdoor garden, when you're not talking as a house plant or in a terrarium or something, it kind of just disappears. You just don't really even see it.
Yeah.
Especially, obviously, in a shade garden. They're going to be really recessive to the eye there. And we were talking also about some begonia relatives or maybe some rare species that maybe the home gardener wouldn't have access to and maybe see at a local botanic garden.
Yeah, the funny thing is begonias don't have any really close relatives. Now, like I said earlier, the begonia family is huge, but it only has two genera. Now, the genus Begonia, which has 1,500 species of begonias, and there's exactly one other genus in the entire family, and it has exactly one species, and it's found in Hawaii, and that's the genus Hillebrandia. And if you looked at it, you would say, that's a begonia. I mean, I gotta say, it looks a lot like a begonia. So it's one of those rare things that people cultivate occasionally. You might see it in the wild if you knew where to look in Hawaii, but it's not something that you're gonna see very often. Now, once you start getting outside the family, some of the closest relatives of the begonia family are trees, like giant trees in the tropics, which is kind of weird. But their other relatives are the cucumber family. That's really funny because if you think about it, you know, cucumbers, squashes, melons, if you look at them, you could kind of see that they're related to begonias, just the way they have like those fleshy petioles and those big, big leaves. So you would never expect that really, but those really are among the closer relatives of begonias.
Yeah. Now that you mention it, John, I was just cutting a bunch of zucchini yesterday in the vegetable garden, and that big giant zucchini leaf does look like a big Rex begonia leaf.
Yeah.
Interesting. So if you catch the begonia bug and you really want to get into collecting and maybe even showing begonias, I would imagine you would join the American Begonia Society or maybe a local chapter.
Yeah, so the American Begonia Society is kind of international in scope, but I would say that probably the majority of the members are in the United States and maybe Canada. So that is the go-to society. And they do have, they're not called chapters, they're called branches. So there are local branches of the American Begonia Society, and they're scattered kind of all over the United States. There are several out on the West Coast, not quite as many on the East Coast, but the closest one to the Washington, D.C. area is the Potomac Valley branch of the American Begonia Society.
And do they meet in person, or is it just an annual show and sale?
Both. I mean, they do meet in person. I did let my membership lapse a few years ago just because I got too busy with other things in my life. They meet generally at a member's home. I believe, once a month, but they do have an annual show and sale at, Green Spring, at the Green Spring Gardens Botanical Garden. So every August, they do have a very nice flower show there, and they do sell plants also.
Great. So we'll have people look out for that and try to alert them. And that's in Fairfax County, Virginia, for those outside the Mid-Atlantic area, if they're curious about coming to visit for that show and sale. And so, John, how can listeners contact you to find out more?
Well, I'm all over social media as DC Tropics. That was the name of my blog for several years. I stopped blogging a few years ago, but I did have a blog. And if you look up DC Tropics, you'll probably find my blog and a lot of information about begonias, because that's one of the things that I blogged about. But you can find me as DC Tropics on Instagram. You can find me as DC Tropics on Facebook. And I would say try to contact me through one of those social media accounts.
Great. And so for summing up the episode, what would you say in conclusion to the person who has never grown a begonia before, why they should grow begonias?
Well, I think one reason is that they're generally easy to grow. They're very gratifying to grow. They have beautiful foliage. Some of them do have very nice flowers, but like I said, I consider the flowers to be a bonus. They're easy to find. That's one big advantage of begonias. They're not like one of the rarest things on earth. You can find a begonia at pretty much any garden center. And another reason I like begonias is because people know what they are. If you say begonia, people know what have some idea of what a begonia is. My other passion is the Gesneriad family. And if I say the word Gesneriad, 99 out of 100 people will have no clue what I'm talking about. So it's kind of gratifying to talk about begonias and have people know what I'm talking about or what I'm growing.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, John, for sharing your begonia knowledge and passion. And maybe we'll have to have you come back sometime soon to talk all about the Gesneriad family, because I am an African violet collector myself.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kathy.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Salvia Black and Blue Plant Profile. Salvia guarnetica Black and Blue is a tender perennial salvia. It has bright green foliage and brilliant blue flowers with purple-black calyxes. Digital photos don't do it justice. It is a true blue flower that really is striking to see in person in the late summer to early autumn garden. It is also known as anise-scented sage black and blue and the Brazilian anise sage black and blue. The Latin names were previously Salvia cerulea and Salvia melanocalyx. Butterflies, hummingbirds, and other pollinators love its tubular flowers. The leaves are fragrant and deer do not bother it. It grows best in full sun in well-drained soil. It will flop if planted in too much shade. It grows to 2 to 5 feet high and wide. Deadhead the spent flowers to encourage additional blooms. Otherwise, it's pretty low maintenance. It's hardy to USDA zones 7 through 10 and can survive here in the Mid-Atlantic if we have a mild winter. But if you think we will have a hard winter, cut it back and pot up several plants divisions in the fall for overwintering in a sunny window. Salvia Black and Blue, you can grow that. What's new in the garden this week? Well, we finally got a little bit of much needed rain after this heat spell, but we could use a lot more rain. And I'm sure many of you out there listening are in that same boat. In the community garden plot, I am looking to harvest our sweet potato soon. And in my home garden, I'm enjoying the blooms of the pink turtlehead chelonia and also the yellows that come at the end of summer, beginning of fall, including goldenrod and some of the perennial helianthus sunflower relatives. I wanted to mention a new segment or benefit. If you follow this show on Spotify, so just make sure you're subscribing to it on the Spotify app, there are polls at many of the most recent episodes, and you can share your thoughts and reactions about the episodes there. And maybe I'll be pulling some of those reactions and sharing them in future What's New segments. So definitely share what you love, what you don't love, what you'd like to hear more about in those listener polls on Spotify. And another place to share your opinions is on the Facebook.com Washington Gardener magazine page. This week, there is a very lively discussion going on about pokeweed. I thought I posted pretty innocuous little photo of beautiful pokeweed berries that I came across, but I mentioned that they are toxic to the touch, which I had sourced from newhampshire.edu and a WebMD site. And of course, you know, not the best thing to eat either. But you thought I would have called somebody's baby ugly because there was a visceral reaction to my post correcting me that it is not toxic to the touch, but I am still doing research on that and seeing the truth behind it, because it does seem like some people do have a touch or reactive skin rash to being around pokeweed, similar to that of poison ivy. So trying to get to the bottom of that, and I'd love for you to comment on your opinions about pokeweed. Do you love it? Do you consider it a garden thug? Are you having it ripped out? Have you had reactions personally to it when touching it? I'd love to hear everybody's opinion in that ongoing conversation on our Facebook page. Some upcoming local gardening events that you might want to attend include the Silver Spring Garden Club meeting taking place at Brookside Gardens in Wheaton, Maryland on Monday, September 18th at 7:30 p.m. This speaker meeting is open and free to all, and it is about Dumbarton Oaks, the evolution of a garden. And you can find out more about that at silverspringgardenclub.com. Next is the Foodie Friday Saving Seeds and Stories series. This is a $10 fee, and it takes place on Friday, September 22nd at 6:30 p.m. at the Josiah Henson Museum and Park in Rockville, Maryland. And you can register for that and find out more at montgomeryparks.org. And next, the Maryland Native Plant Society is having their monthly program via Zoom, and that is on Research on Maryland's Dying Ash Forests by Andrew Baldwin. And you can register for that at mdflora.org under their events tab. And then finally, the Fall Festival and Bulb Sale at the U.S. National Arboretum is on September 30th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. They have 52 different types of bulbs for sale, ranging from alliums to irises to tulips. You don't need to register, but they'd like to know to expect you there, so you can find out more at Fona, F-O-N-A, fona.org. Happy gardening!
In the new book, The Urban Garden, by Kathy Jensen Terry Spate, you'll find dozens of inspiring and creative ways to grow flowers, shrubs, vegetables, herbs, and other plants in small spaces and with a limited budget. Whether you want to grow on a balcony, rooftop, front stoop, or a tiny urban patio, turn your growing dreams into reality and build a gorgeous and unique garden that showcases your personal style while still being functional and productive. With the ingenious ideas and resourceful tactics found here, you'll be maximizing yields and beauty from every square inch of your space while also making a lush outdoor living area you'll crave spending time in. Whether you're growing edible plants or beautiful flowers, the 101 amazing growing ideas found in the Urban Garden will turn your tiny urban yard into a treasure trove of green you'll be proud to share with family and friends. Buy your copy today at your local retail bookseller or order it online now at Amazon.com or bookshop.org. Get low-maintenance alternative to lawns with the new book Ground Cover Revolution by Kathy Jentz. Reducing the lawn is among the biggest trends in homeownership, with an endless stream of homeowners looking for an eco-friendly alternative to a traditional, everyday grass lawn. In the last few years alone, over 23 million American adults converted part of the lawn to a natural landscape and now are looking to do even more. The biggest challenge to adopting this new ideal of the perfect lawn is knowing how and when to replace your turf and which plants are the best ones for the job. Ground Cover Revolution is here with all the answers you need. Included are 40 in-depth profiles of plants that are perfect choices for replacing a grass lawn. There are options for sun, for shade, for dry and wet sites, and for various climates around the globe. There are choices that bloom, options that are evergreen, and selections that are deer-resistant. Author Kathy Jentz has also included an incredibly useful chart that gives you all the details on each of the 40 choices for quick reference and to make your ground cover selection process even easier. Whether you want to replace the entire lawn or just reduce the amount of land dedicated to turf, Ground Cover Revolution will help you usher in a new and improved idea of what a beautiful lawn should be. Available at bookstores now and also at Quarto.com, where you can get 30% off using discount code GARDENING30.
This is The Last Word on Raspberries by Christy Page at Food Gardening Network. I am definitely a berry girl, and raspberries are at the absolute top of my list. Part of it is the sweet, juicy goodness, and some of it is the memories that they conjure. Growing up, my grandparents had a ton of raspberry bushes in their backyard. All summer long, my cousins and I would feast on these berries. Now, technically, we were not supposed to eat all of them, and I'm sure my grandparents wanted a few for themselves, but every time I was there, I was drawn to those bushes and the warm, sweet berries. My sticky hands always betrayed what I had been up to, but my grandmother would chuckle and my grandfather would joke that one of these days I would turn into a raspberry. When I finally had a yard large enough to garden in, the first request was for a raspberry bush. My husband decided that the perfect birthday present was starting my very own raspberry patch. He purchased 4 bushes, a couple of trellises, and some fertilizer. All summer long, I watched those bushes grow and even managed to have a few raspberries. It was one of the best birthday presents ever. The next year, we noticed that the plants had multiplied. Not only did I have my 4 original sturdy bushes, but there were also several other smaller bushes sprouting up around them. We started having to watch carefully where we weed whacked or mowed to make sure that we did not harm any of these precious plants. In the next few years, these bushes continued to multiply until I really did have my own raspberry patch. Every morning, all summer long, you would see me out there picking berries, although I will say very few actually made it into the house. I love them warm, sweet, and freshly plucked. Then came last year. We had a horrible storm that poured buckets of rain. It washed out a large part of our yard right where my precious raspberries were. When it came time to repair the damage, it was very hard to save the few bushes remaining. We had to have new topsoil brought in, and that whole area was redone. My heart was broken, but I figured we could start again. Imagine my surprise this year when my husband came in from mowing to tell me that I have new raspberry bushes growing. Between the rain and the yard work, the tiny bushes and seeds were pushed more to the edges of the yard. Instead of one raspberry patch, I now have bushes lining most of the backyard. They're still small, but they're definitely growing. I can't wait for next year and hopefully a bounty of sweet treats each morning. Until then, it may be time for a quick trip to my grandparents' house. This was The Last Word on Raspberries with Christy Page at foodgardening.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to anchor.fm/gardendc/support. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.com. Thank you. You can find Washington Gardener online at washingtongardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDCGardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.